It is not this incident had a more drastic impact than any other. In 1957, the maritime nations, within the framework of the United Nations General Assembly, correctly enunciated the doctrine of free and innocent passage through the straits. Now, when that doctrine was proclaimed, and incidentally not challenged by the Egyptian representative at that time, it was little more than an abstract principle for the maritime world. For Israel, it was a great but still unfulfilled prospect. It was not yet a reality. But during 10 years in which we and the other states in the maritime community have relied upon that doctrine and upon established usage, the principle has become a reality. Consecrated by hundreds of sailings under dozens of flags and the establishment of a whole complex of commerce and industry and communications, a new dimension has been added to the map of the world's communications. And on that dimension, we have constructed Israel's bridge towards the friendly states of Asia and Africa, a network of relationships which is the chief pride of Israel in the second decade of her independence. All this then had grown up as an effective usage under the United Nations flag. Does Mr. Nasser really think that he can come upon the scene in 10 minutes and cancel the established legal usage and interests of 10 years? There was in this wanton act a quality of malice, for surely the closing of the Straits of Tiran gave no benefit whatever to Egypt except the perverse joy of inflicting injury on others. It was an anarchic act because it showed a total regard for the law of nations, whose application in this specific case had not been challenged for 10 years. And it was, in the literal sense, an act of arrogance, because there are other nations in Asia and East Africa who trade with the port of Eilat, as they have every right to do, through the Straits of Tiran and across the Gulf of Aqaba. Other sovereign states from Japan to Ethiopia, from Thailand to Uganda, from Cambodia to Madagascar, have a sovereign right to decide for themselves whether they wish or do not wish to trade with Israel. These Cairo, they can trade with Israel or not trade with Israel as they wish. And President Nasser is not the policeman of other African and Asian states. Here then was a wanton intervention in the sovereign rights of other states in the eastern half of the world to decide for themselves whether or not they wished to establish trade relations with each or both or either of the two ports at the head of the Gulf of Aqaba. When we examine then the implications of this act, we have no cause to wonder that the international shock was great. There is another reason for that shock. Blockades have traditionally been regarded in the pre-charter parlance as acts of war. To blockade, after all, is to attempt strangulation. And sovereign states are entitled not to have their trade strangled. To understand how the state of Israel felt, one merely has to look around this table and imagine a foreign power, for example, forcibly closing New York or Montreal or Boston or Marseille or Toulon or Copenhagen or Rio or Tokyo or Bombay Harbor. How would your governments react? What would you do? How long would you wait? But Israel waited because of her confidence that the other maritime powers and countries interested in this new trading pattern would concert their influence in order to reestablish a legal situation and to liquidate this blockade. We concerted action with them not because Israel's national interest was here abdicated. There will not, there cannot be an Israel without Eilat. We cannot be expected to return to a dwarfed stature with our face to the Mediterranean alone. In law and history, peace and blockades have never coexisted. How could it be expected that the blockade of Eilat and the relaxation of tension in the Middle East could ever be brought into harmony? These then were the three main elements in the tension: the sabotage movements, the blockade of the port, and perhaps more imminent than anything else, this vast and purposeful encirclement movement against the background of an authorized presidential statement announcing that the objective of the encirclement was to bring about the destruction and the annihilation of a sovereign state. Now, these acts taken together, the blockade, the dismissal of the United Nations force, and the heavy concentration in Sinai, effectively disrupted the status quo, which had ensured a relative stability on the Egyptian-Israeli frontier for 10 years. I do not use these words, relative stability, lightly, for in fact, while those elements in the Egyptian-Israeli relationship existed, there was not one single incident of violence between Egypt and Israel for 10 years. Suddenly, this status quo, this pattern of mutually accepted stability, was smashed to smithereens. And it is now the task of the governments concerned to elaborate the new conditions of their coexistence. I think that much of this work should be done directly by these governments themselves. Surely after what has happened, we must have better assurance than before for Israel and for the Middle East of peaceful coexistence. The question is whether there is any reason to believe that such a new era might yet come to pass. If I am a little sanguine on this point, it is because of a conviction that men and nations do behave wisely once they have exhausted all other alternatives. Surely, the other alternatives of war and belligerency have now been exhausted. What has anybody gained from them? But in order that the new system of interstate relationships might flourish in the Middle East, it is important that certain principles be applied above and beyond the ceasefire to which the Security Council has given its unanimous support. Let me then say here that Israel welcomes the appeal for the ceasefire as formulated in this resolution. But I must point out that the implementation depends on an absolute and sincere acceptance and cooperation of the other parties, which in our view are responsible for the present situation. And in conveying this resolution to my colleagues, I must at this moment point out that these other governments have not used the opportunity yet to clarify their intentions. I've said, Mr. President, that the situation to be constructed after the ceasefire must depend upon certain principles. The first of these principles surely must be the acceptance of Israel's statehood and the total elimination of the fiction of her non-existence. It would seem to me that after 3,000 years, the time has arrived to accept Israel's nationhood as a fact. For here is the only state in the international community which has the same territory, speaks the same language, and upholds the same faith as it did 3,000 years ago. And if, as everybody knows to be the fact, the universal conscience was in the last week or two most violently shaken at the prospect of danger to Israel, it was not only because there seemed to be a danger to a state, but also, I think, because the state was Israel, with all that this ancient name evokes, teaches, symbolizes and inspires. How grotesque would be an international community which found room for 127 sovereign units and which did not acknowledge the sovereignty of that people which had given nationhood its deepest significance and its most enduring grace. No wonder then that when danger threatened, we could hear a roar of indignation sweep across the world, that men in progressive movements, members of the scientific and humanistic cultures, joined together in sounding an alarm bell about an issue that vitally affected the human conscience. And no wonder, correspondingly, that a deep and universal sense of satisfaction and relief has accompanied the news of Israel's gallant and successful resistance. But the central point remains the need to secure an authentic intellectual recognition by our neighbors of Israel's deep roots in the Middle Eastern reality. There is an intellectual tragedy in the failure of Arab leaders to come to grips, however reluctantly, with the depth and authenticity of Israel's roots in the life, the history, the spiritual experience, and the culture of the Middle East. This then is the first axiom, a much more conscious and uninhibited acceptance of Israel's statehood as an axiom requiring no demonstration, for there will never be a Middle East without an independent and sovereign of Israel in its midst. The second principle must be that of a peaceful settlement of disputes. The resolution thus adopted falls within the concept of the Pacific settlement of disputes. I've already said that much could be done if the governments of the area would embark much more on direct contacts. They must find their way to each other. After all, when there is conflict between them, they come together face to face. Why should they not come together face to face to solve the conflict? And perhaps on some occasions it would not be a bad idea to have the solution before and therefore instead of the conflict. When the Council discusses what is to happen after the ceasefire, we hear many formulas back to 1956, back to 1948. I understand our neighbors would wish to turn the clock back to 1947. The fact is, however, that most clocks move forward and not backward. And this, I think, should be the case with the clock of Middle Eastern peace. Not backward to belligerency, but forward to peace. The point was well made this evening by the distinguished representative of Argentina, who said the ceasefire must be followed immediately by the most energetic efforts to find a just and true peace in the Middle East. In a similar sense, the distinguished representative of Canada warned us against merely reproducing the old conditions of conflict without attempting to settle the underlying issues of Arab-Israeli coexistence. After all, many things in recent days have been mixed up with each other. Few things are what they were. And in order to create harmonious combinations of relationships, it is inevitable that the states should come together in negotiation. Another factor in the harmony that we would like to see in the Middle East relates to external powers. From these, and especially from the greatest amongst them, the small states of the Middle East, and most of them are small, ask for a rigorous support, not for individual states, but for specific principles. Not to be for one state against other states, but to be for peace against war, for free commerce against belligerency, for the Pacific settlement of disputes against violent, irredentist threats. In other words, to exercise an even-handed support for the integrity and independence of states and for the rights of states under the Charter of the United Nations and other sources of international law. There are no two categories of states. The United Arab Republic, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, not one of these has a single ounce or milligram of statehood which does not adhere in equal measure to Israel itself. It is important that states outside our region apply a balanced attitude, that they do not exploit temporary tensions and divergences in the issues of global conflict, that they do not seek to win gains by inflaming fleeting passions, and that they strive to make a balanced distribution of their friendship amongst the states of the Middle East. Now, whether all the speeches of all the great powers this evening meet this criterion, everybody, of course, can judge for himself. I do not propose to answer in detail all the observations of the distinguished representative of the Soviet Union. I had the advantage of hearing the same things in identical language a few days ago from his colleague, the Soviet ambassador in Israel. I must convince that I was no more convinced this evening than I was the day before yesterday about the validity of this most vehement and one-sided denunciation. But surely world opinion, before whose tribunal this debate unrolls, can solve this question by posing certain problems to itself. Who was it that attempted to destroy a neighboring state in 1948? Israel or its neighbors? Who now closes an international waterway to the port of a neighboring state? Israel or the United Arab Republic? Does Israel refuse to negotiate a peace settlement with the Arab states, or they with it? Who disrupted the 1957 pattern of stability? Israel or Egypt? Did troops of Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Lebanon, Kuwait, Algeria surround Israel in this menacing confrontation? Or has any distinguished representative seen some vast Israeli colossus surrounding the area between Morocco and Kuwait? I raise these points of elementary logic. Of course, a great power can take refuge in its power from the exigencies of logic. All of us in our youth presumably recounted La Fontaine's fable, "La raison du plus fort est toujours la meilleure." But here, after all, there's nobody who is more or less strong than others. We sit here around the table on the concept of sovereign equality, and I think we have an equal duty for bringing substantive proof for any denunciation that we make each of the other. Conclusion, Mr. President, these are, of course, still grave times, and yet they may perhaps have fortunate issue. This could be the case if those who, for some reason, decided so violently to disrupt the status quo 3 weeks ago would ask themselves what the results and benefits have been as he looks around him at the arena of battle, at the wreckage of planes and tanks, at the collapse of intoxicated hopes. Might not an Egyptian ruler ponder whether anything was achieved by that disruption? What has it brought but strife, conflict with other powerful interests, and the stern criticism of progressive men throughout the world? I think that Israel has proved her steadfastness and vigor in recent days. She is now willing to demonstrate her instinct for peace. Let us build a new system of relationships from the wreckage of the old. Let us discern across the darkness the vision of a better and a brighter dawn. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. shall I?